Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm going to call the meeting to order. Just welcome you here today, and I guess start with doing introductions. I'll start. I'm James Maroney. I think the only people who don't know are probably people sitting out there. So I'll pass it on to Roberta, and then we'll go around the room that way and get started with our presentations.
James is, he forgot to mention, the chair of this August group, and thank him for all his hard work. I'm State Representative Roberta Willis, and I chair the Higher Education and Employment Advancement Committee, House Chair.
Good morning, I'm Judy Resnick, and I chair the Planning Commission for Higher Education.
Hi, Alan Shepard, Office of Fiscal Analysis.
Jen Widnes, the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges.
Julie Savino, Executive Director of Student Financial Assistance at Sacred Heart University.
Heather Hamilton, Director of Graduate Financial Aid at Quinnipiac University and CAPFA President.
I'm Rich Bishop, Director of Financial Aid at Central Connecticut State University.
Mark French, Director of Financial Aid for the Office of Higher Education.
Jeanette Weldon, Executive Director of the Connecticut Higher Education Supplemental Loan Authority.
Steve McDowell, Director of Financial Aid Services for the Board of Regents.
Greg DeSantis, Associate Director of Financial Aid at Housatonic Community College and the Faculty Advisory Committee.
Mona Lucas, Director of Student Financial Aid Services, University of Connecticut.
Wayne Locust, Vice President for Enrollment at UConn.
Good morning, Carrie Kelly from the Office of Policy and Management.
I'm Greg Hedad, the State Representative from Mansfield.
Great. Thank you, everyone. Today we are going to continue with the presentations of how the colleges are actually packaging the students. We've heard from Jen and representatives from the independent colleges, Greg on behalf of the community colleges, Rich from Central, but today Mona Lucas from University of Connecticut is going to present to us on how UConn crafts their aid packages, and then after that we're going to have a presentation from Nate Johnson of Strategy Labs. So Mona, if you would take over.
Okay, I'm trying to get...
So annually, we kind of start out with the basics at UConn, reminding ourselves that we're a need-blind institution and that federal methodology determines eligibility for our need-based aid, and we continue to utilize the March 1st as our on-time FAFSA deadline. We also remind ourselves that, you know, that we do not negotiate our financial aid packages or match peer or aspirant packages at all. We do not bait and switch on our strategy. So the strategy the student enters the university under is the financial aid strategy, packaging strategy that follows that student through undergraduate graduation. And our commitment is to ensure that our best packages go to the most needy students from the state of Connecticut. We have guiding principles that our financial aid strategy utilizes, our strategy group. Number one, we have to continue to be true to the university mission and our enrollment goals. All of our decisions are data-driven, and we have to have a rationale and budget-based strategy. Again, reminding ourselves that our best packages are to go to our most needy Connecticut residents. What we do in our strategy development is we start out with a review of last year's strategy. We look at EFC bands and we look at our meritorious quality bands in addition to several other data points. We also look at our tentative budget for the upcoming year, making the assumption from year to year that our governor scholarship allocation will remain the same as we build our tentative budget. And then we start by looking at the demand for our continuing aid applicants first, because again, we have a commitment to this group of students, and we need to establish the amount of money that it will take should they all return for subsequent years. We need to ensure that we have set aside the dollars to renew their aid packages as long as they continue to be on-time financial aid applicants. We then review our new year enrollment goals and develop our tentative strategy, start looking at running yield models and simulations so that we can account for geographic and ethnic diversity. We need to look at our individual academic program capacity and also consider our STEM initiative as we finalize our strategies. And then we determine our tentative go-live dates for packaging releases. So, what does an example package look like at UConn? Well, of course, we always start with the federal Pell Grant. Since we are an FM school, I mean, we start with that eligibility. We then build in a designated amount of gift or grant aid from one or more of the sources listed here as examples. We package full eligibility for subsidized federal Stafford loan, federal direct Stafford, and unsubsidized direct Stafford. And to the extent our allocation allows, we also include federal work study in the packages. So what does a sample package look like and what is the unmet need gap that is typical for a needy UConn student? This slide, I'm showing you sample direct cost, and we actually pulled real data for this. This was back, in September, but we used the examples for students who are in the lowest EFC bands, or otherwise known as our highest need students. We looked at what was the average Pell Grant eligibility. So you can see for the population that we looked at in September, the average Pell Grant for the 0 to 999 band. So for the A directors here, if you're wondering, like, wait a minute, that's not the maximum Pell Grant, you're right. We just looked at the average of the Pell Grant recipients in the cohort we looked at back in September. And then the average gift aid, when I refer to university gift aid, I'm talking about one or more of those programs that I mentioned. I'm really talking about university-controlled gift aid. And then the Stafford loan eligibility that's built into every package, and what's left here for the gap or the unmet need before other sources of aid are considered. These are the gaps for our in-state student or out-of-state student who would be potentially our highest need students. And then if you take a look at when do we actually deliver the news to our students, we typically start releasing new student freshman packages in mid-March each year, and then it's ongoing thereafter as students complete the process. In mid-April, a certain cohort of our transfer packages are released. Some of them go out a bit earlier in March. April is when we start looking at special consideration appeals for our new students, because we fully understand these students need to make a decision by May 1. So we dedicate time in early April for the review of those appeals. And then in late April, we release our continuing undergraduate packages. Our commitment is to get the news out to those students before they go into finals and or leave for the summer break. In late May, once grades are posted for the spring semester, we review satisfactory academic progress for our continuing undergraduates. and our graduate populations. In June, we start reviewing the special circumstance appeals for our continuing undergraduates and graduate students. And then in late June, the university fee bills are released, and those fee bills would reflect anticipated financial aid that's been awarded as of that the date those bills are generated. Mid-September is the time to reconcile everything. So once we've passed our semester census date, we look at enrollment status at that time and reconcile awards accordingly. Okay, that's my high-level overview. I guess I'm happy to answer any questions.
One of the questions that I've asked consistently when hearing from other public institutions or private institutions, how does your policy differ for financial aid awards made to part-time students, if at all?
Our part-time student packaging strategy really consists of Pell Grant eligibility, which can be prorated, obviously, as you may know, and Stafford or direct loan eligibility. We tend to reserve our university dollars for full-time students. However, a small portion of our campus-based or SEOG, to the extent we have Perkins loans ever again, and federal work study can go to part-time students, but we give priority to our full-time undergraduate primary consideration to our full-time undergraduates.
I'm sorry, so just as a follow-up to that, what percentage of your student body is part-time versus full-time?
I don't. Certainly happy to get that data. I don't have that with me. It's a very small percentage because the majority of our undergrads are
full-time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking at your thing, and I just wanted you to help me reconcile one thing. I'm sure there's a reasonable answer to this. So on page 3, you talk about best packages go to most needy Connecticut residents, right? And then when I turn to your comparison of in-state versus out-of-state students, you know, the average university gift to an out-of-state student is nearly twice that of the average in-state student. And so there's obviously a great disparity in terms of the amount that they're being charged. But I was hoping you could just sort of talk me through the first statement and the second chart.
So with the first statement that in-state students receive our best packaging, it's relative to the charge that their cost is relative to their EFC level. And in this case, when we start packaging, we're looking at in-state students who have the lowest EFC level. That's the example that you have here. They receive the highest amount of grant that we would give UConn money to an in-state student. That is the $8,900 or almost $9,000 of grant money. When we look at an out-of-state student, obviously the tuition is a premium, and they pay three times the in-state rate in terms of direct cost. It's almost double the cost. We therefore net more revenue from the out-of-state student than we do an in-state student, even after financial aid is awarded, need-based financial aid.
And then my last question, I guess, is I was intrigued by this statement again on page 3. No packaging strategy bait and switch. I'm not sure I followed you entirely when you were talking about that. Could you sort of flesh that out a little bit more for me?
We are committed to the initial packages that students receive as new freshmen coming in. So that if they receive, in this particular case, about $9,000 in UConn grant money, they can anticipate receiving $9,000 in the subsequent years for year 2, 3, and 4. as opposed to dropping out or dropping or reducing the UConn grant money. Many institutions around the country would sweeten the first year package award, and then in subsequent years you would see a reduction in their institutional commitment. That's not the case at UConn.
Thank you for that question. Thank you for your presentation. Obviously, with cutbacks, it is understandable why UConn would seek out out-of-state students and are increasing that percentage overall, because even with all that money that's being given to an out-of-state student, they still are paying well over. I have a question about the Governor's Scholarship Program. It's not clear to me in this chart where that comes in. And I was hoping you could show.
Sure. On the example package where it says UConn gift, that is where it comes in. What we do initially is just award all the money out the door as UConn grant, because we don't have final allocations that early in order for us to go out in March. We don't know what our actual allocations are going to be, so we award everything up front as UConn grant. Once we get our allocation and we confirm residency status and other eligibility factors, we replace those university dollars with the governor's scholarship.
And then you can give more to the out-of-state. Okay.
No, we don't give more to the out-of-state.
The pool. You received in the governor's scholarship, and I'm not sure how accurate this number is, but in the last go-around, it looked like an increase of $1 million from the state of Connecticut for governor's scholarship.
Correct. Over $1 million. Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I just add something? I think it's important that everyone understands that UConn does not meet the full need of any student. The financial need that our students have at overall, in-state as well as out-of-state, is very significant. We could not begin to meet the gap that our students have. So we stretch the dollars as far as we possibly can, given the mission and goals of the university that we have and what students come into the university with.
I wonder if I could follow up on that then.
Sure.
So the example that you gave in terms of the student with a zero EFC who walks away still after the package with a $6,100 gap, how do you have any data on the numbers of students like that choose not to come? I mean, do you have any sense
Sure.
of, because I've got to think that $6,000 for somebody with that level of need could be a no-go.
That's a good question. So another factor that we consider in awarding the amount is the yield rate. Students who accept our offer, students who deny our offer of admission. In this particular case of students with EFC at 0 to 999, in-state students, our yield rate is over 50%. So we'll make two offers, and one student will decide to enroll. And that is a significant yield rate for this population of students, even though the gap is still significant as we look at it. Okay. But having an over 50% yield rate, and that's been pretty consistent over time. Jen?
How many of the Connecticut students with an EFC under 11,000 do you think get the governor's scholarship?
I don't have that data with me. I'm happy to bring it back. I mean, it's available. It's simple as running a report, but I didn't bring that.
And Mona, you correct me if I'm wrong. We did have $1 million increase in the governor's scholarship from about $6 million to $7 million this past cycle. Our total UConn grant budget is about $80 million, including the $7 million from the scholarship, governor's scholarship.
You get merit. Is your total allocation around 14 from governor's scholarship, including the merit?
The merit is outside of the 80 million base. So the merit money is outside of the $80 million that we spend in total, which includes the UConn grant need-based portion of the governor's scholarship.
Oh, that's so the merit is not included in the university gift? Is that, would that be?
Are you asking about the Connecticut merit?
I was just clarifying for you that if you don't include the need merit, is that outside of the need base? They're both governor scholarship, right? So.
Right, the merit, the piece that comes to us via the rosters, is not reflected here. And the other question, let me just make sure I got it in case you want me to follow up, which I'm happy to do. Are you asking on the need-based side how many students with how many in-state students with a EFC of 11,000 or higher received, below 11,000 received governor's need?
Which one
are you at?
I was just curious that if you have a $14 million allocation from governor scholarship grant total, what percentage of Connecticut students are getting some form of governor scholarship?
So we'd have to look at that. What we control is $7.9 million, and the others come to an extent. So if you want to know a breakdown of the recipients at UConn, how they fall, which EFC bands they fall into, is that what you're asking for?
I was just curious how many Connecticut students receive some form of governor scholarship aid need or need merit.
Oh, what percentage of UConn students receive funding from either of the sources, whether the need-based, what I would think of as need-based, as well as the merit? Yeah, we can, I don't know that, I don't have that with me, but I'm sure it's a easy data point to pull.
Does anyone else have questions before I ask a few?
I had one question. Mona, in the determination of merit-based aid on your matrix and your packaging policies, is there any difference between in-state or out-of-state, or are students giving merit? Because I see such a wide disparity in these awards. Is that all, would that be the average, would be need-based dollars between the out-of-state, or would merit be the same? Is merit the same regardless of whether they're in-state or out-of-state?
The merit, are you asking, is the merit criteria the same for
Correct.
In-state?
Oh, yeah.
The merit criteria, whether in-state or out-of-state, is the same. The value of the merit scholarship will differ for the out-of-state population.
Okay, so that's what I'm saying. Okay, the criteria stays the same, but the amount of the award differs if you're an in-state versus an out-of-state. Say, for example, so the in-state student with the same merit qualifications would receive less.
Correct.
Than the out-of-state student.
Right, because of the differential in the tuition.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so, all right, I have a few questions. First, so you initially package the students and you say you're going to get $9,000, $89.55 in grant aid. We've heard before that sometimes when the students are, because they receive the notification from OHE separately that they may be eligible for the need merit piece, and that some of them feel like money has been taken away from them. You don't have that issue at all with your students, that when you reallocate their money, so they're still getting $9,000, but you tell them this is university money, this is governor scholarship money, that doesn't create any issues?
It shouldn't on the what I'm thinking of is merit side, because it should go first to the gap, and then if the student for some reason has received an outside award that has filled the gap, then we reduce the most undesirable aid program, which should be a loan. So if they are recipients of that merit piece, it should be a true add-on, and we should only have to adjust something if they have additional, like, you know, some of the students definitely come in with other sources of aid, or they're recipients of departmental aid, maybe perhaps from the university or other sources. So, but if when you hear these things, I mean, if you have a couple of examples, I could take a look, because it shouldn't decrease the value of our what we consider planned gift. Now, yeah, on the merits, right. Now, if the question really is the need-based piece, then I could understand why they would think that, because it goes out as UConn, and then when we reconcile or know what our allocations are and figure out who the eligible recipients are, maybe you started out with a $9,000 UConn award, and now you have a $4,000 UConn award and a $5,000 governor's grant, governor's scholarship. But I could certainly look at if there are a couple other, if you have a couple of examples, I could, you know, take a look.
Well, I didn't have any specific examples. I was just going off of what people had said in the past, just wondering if that had created an issue for you, since you sent it out as a kind of an estimate in a way. This is grant aid, and then once they saw the specifics, if there were concerns. Now, do you have a target for average percentage of need met for students? And it looks like, I mean, here the remaining unmet need is, in this example, 6,000, so, but really, it's 8,000 because 2,000 of unsubsidized Stafford loan has gone towards that. So, percentage of need met, it's about 2/3. Is that
what we're utilizing
students?
Is per EFC band, and what in our strategy we have a designated amount of grant aid we plan for each EFC band. So we start out like I indicated with the 0 to 999. Our plan is $9,000, which represents a certain percentage of tuition and fees, and which is roughly 80%. And then we go to the next EFC band, 1,000 to something, and we give, let's say $8,500, and that represents 73% of tuition and fees. That's how our strategy works.
Great. So that is, so you are kind of targeting. You're trying to meet a specific percentage of need, and it so it varies based on the EFC.
Absolutely. So when we look at our tuition, we want to make sure in the lowest EFC band, for example, that we're going to meet at least 80% of their tuition costs with gift aid. And then as you go higher on the EFC, it will be lower, as Mona indicated. That's right.
Thank you. And then what percentage of gift aid comes from the UConn Foundation, and are there specific restrictions on that aid?
Certainly. The money we are able to control in enrollment planning, the unrestricted foundation dollars are limited. Roughly $400,000 a year we have in unrestricted that, you know, allows us to assist, additional students. We're hoping that will grow as there's a campaign underway currently. So as that grows, obviously we'll be in a position. We're hoping to be in a position to offer more attractive packages, more gift aid or grant dollars in our packages, and less dependence on either a parent loan or borrowing the full eligibility for Stafford direct loans. That's our hope.
Or a Chesla loan.
Or a Chesla, absolutely.
Right.
Or the Chesla scholarships.
Thank you again. The number that you've given is average gift for in-states and for out-of-state. My question is, what is that range? Particularly for an out-of-state, what's the range that you might give? I mean, that range, I assume, could go up to the whole 47,000. Is that no? What is it?
Let me just look at something here. No,
I shouldn't say that because you're taking out the Pell and you're taking out.
Yeah, but that's a fantasy that we wouldn't be able to achieve to give that amount of gift, whether it came from a portion from our foundation, the university, outside agencies that we work with. we cap the maximum gift for each EFC band, an in-state amount and an out-of-state. So this average was just slightly less than what our planned was. Let me just look at my chart here just a sec. Right. The maximum for out-of-state first band was $17,500.
So an out-of-state student would not receive more than $17,000.
You're absolutely correct.
Okay. And your in-state student maximum amount would be?
$8,500.
But the average is $89,000, so how could it be $8,500?
Because this population is a population, this is a real population that we looked at. Some of them apparently received funding from another university source, like maybe a departmental scholarship our most prestigious presidential scholarship could Nutmeg or Day of Pride are our full ride scholarships, and their value is higher, slightly higher for the in-state population. So there have to be a few Nutmeg scholarship or Day of Pride scholarship recipients perhaps in here. And when we look at average gift, we're looking at university sources in addition to the need-based sources. So there's probably a handful of those in there. That's why the average is slightly higher than the planned average on the in-state side.
And we also have a presidential scholarship, which is awarded to Connecticut valedictorians and salutatorians, which is full tuition. So that will be calculated in here for students who fit into this EFC band.
And one other question. So merit scholarships, I assume, are decided by the admissions, and then the need base is decided by financial aid office. Julie?
When I'm looking at this university gift aid, I don't see anything for here for the SEOG or the other Title IV gift aid. Where would that appear for somebody in this in these bands here?
The SEOG would eventually appear for our zero EFC students. So if we plan $8,500 as maximum gift for a 0 to 999 student, after our census date reconciliation, a handful of freshmen, let's just say our SEOG allocation is not significant enough to help everyone who's financially eligible, so we target those with a zero EFC. So we would give $4,000 of the $8,500 in SEOG after census date. So initially, you're not going to see any SEOG on the table. You're not going to see any governor scholarship. You're not going to see any, what am I missing? Campus space. Oh, yeah, you will see. Yeah. So you're not going to see SEOG. You're not going to see governors. And after the reconciliation, you will see it. But the planned gift will be reduced by the amount of those awards.
Okay, so just so that I understand this as I'm seeing it, so you would say, for example, in this group, out of the $8,500, which would be their maximum award, as you just said, so that would be the maximum award. So then after reconciliation, this particular student might have $4,000 reassigned to SEOG, and then another $3,500 reassigned to governor's need. And then so the remaining amount would then be university aid, which would be about $1,000.
You're absolutely right.
Okay. So when you package that, I only know anytime you change anything on a student, particularly when there's a gap on need, you know, they all, you know, panic, students and parents together. Do you actually put that in a disclosure or disclaimer against these students when you package that? Say, for example, your university gift aid may change after a certain date. Do you tell them that up front, or, you know, is there?
Yes.
You know, when's the notification process to the student to understand the changes that have taken place?
Yeah, that is disclosed up front. Whether it translates into what we would like it to translate into, I can't say, other than we don't, we all know, those of us who are aid administrators, when they don't understand, your phones ring off the hook and mom and dad are emailing and all of that. So the population, the majority of the population gets it. So that tells us the way we're communicating it must be effective because, you know, other than a handful, there's always a few people who don't quite understand, but the masses seem to understand. This has been our process for 4 years, and you know we would hear from many people if they weren't fully understanding, because everybody thinks the additional programs would be add-ons, and so they're quite vocal, as you all have probably experienced, as we do, when they don't quite understand. Yep. So they do get a revised award letter, again, but
follow up to that, if I might. So you also mentioned that once they get the merit piece, that we get the notification from the department, that's an additional award. So in this particular case, it would be that the student would have had an offset of $4,000. University aid would have remained at the $4,500, and then they would get the additional, say, $4,500 in their merit-based aid. So that the student actually would have an increased package because you would not have gone back.
Correct. And what in the process we have in place with our departments who are interested in cooperating with us, if many times they will reach out to us first to say, we've selected these students and we want to make sure it's not going to have a negative impact to their need-based financial aid, so we can at least let them know in advance of notifying the student that, oh, this student's need is met, so we're going to have to reduce his loan, or no, this student has a $5,000 gap. Anything you award up to $5,000 will not change the package, so the students see that as a true add-on.
I think to James' question to you, Mona, about the confusion, I think from the private college sector, the reason it's confusing is that they give out, if they give anything out, they would give out the need-based governor scholarship grant as need-based governor scholarship grant, not as a university gift. And so that's why it's confusing.
Well, I'm using the terminology university gift. That's our terminology. Internally we call it university controlled gift aid, and it just means a combination of the university money, SEOG, what we anticipate getting from the state, because in the early stages of our policy development and strategy development, when we get to a certain point, we have to look at how much do we think we're going to have from all sources? So we do the same thing. Many years we'll have a tentative SEOG allocation by the time we are looking at strategy, but I mean it's not a significant allocation. So, you know, anything's better than zero. The significant allocation is certainly our state allocation and our university allocation. So from a strategy development perspective, we're putting it all together to see the maximum amount we can offer our needy students is X million dollars. When we send it out, yes, what the families see, they don't see university gift or university planned gift. What the individual student initially sees or parent is UConn grant, $9,000. And then later in the, after the fall census date, they then see revised award notification with an explanation as to what changed, and then if they look at the dollars and the individual programs, they're going to see $1,000 University of Connecticut grant, $4,000 federal SEOG, $3,500 Connecticut Governor Scholarship. So they see there's no overall value change, but they see the actual program names. So if I wasn't clear about what is university gift and do we call it all university gift, we don't. It's an internal strategy committee language.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Wayne and Mona, would you be willing to answer questions if people had them by email afterwards? because I'm concerned because I know Nate has flown up from Florida to give his presentation, so I want to make sure he has enough.
Oh, absolutely. Time. Any additional questions, send them our way. We'll get you a response. Happy to do so.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you, you know, Wayne and Mona, for making that presentation. Nate, if you'd like to come up to make your presentation, introduce Nate Johnson. We're fortunate to have him come visit us today, and I just want to Nate is with the Strategy Labs, Lumina Foundation Strategy Labs. He is a policy leader around financial aid. He travels all around the country speaking about financial aid. He is from Florida, but he was born in Connecticut, so we welcome him back up here, and hopefully his blood didn't get too thin, so he's okay with our winter. So, and also, I wanted to thank Malia, who is also with HCM Strategies, and she helped to get Nate here for us today. And I want to make it clear that this is all through the Lumina Foundation, that it was really, it's at no cost to us. He does have our eternal gratitude, and we are working on getting him eternal salvation on his deathbed. So he'll have that going for him. So, Nate, I'll turn it over to you.
That'll be worth it then. Thank you. I need a minute. I'm having a little trouble loading this. I might just plug in my own laptop here. So as the chair pointed out, I work for the Strategy Labs. I have my own consulting business based in Tallahassee, Florida, and one of my jobs is to represent the Strategy Labs in talking with states about how financial aid policy relates to the goals that many states, including Connecticut, have set for increasing higher education attainment. Lumina's goal is to have 60% of the population have a college credential by 2025, and Connecticut, I think, has set a goal in similar terms for its state. I like to start sometimes talking with states by just injecting a little bit of historical perspective about the idea of college costs and affordability, which have been an issue almost since college have existed, certainly going back to some interesting passages in Shakespeare and probably before, if I could find some. But I thought this was good. If you think back to Prohibition days and some of the things students had to do or opportunity students had then to raise money for college. So this is about students being arrested for peddling illegal alcohol in order to pay for their tuition. It's something that we've struggled with as long as college has been around. So this describes the strategy labs, and I will provide this to send around to the task force participants and anybody else who is interested. And just note that I am representing my own analysis here and not officially the perspective of the foundation. Our principles for financial support relative to the goal in the strategy labs are that we want to make college more affordable for low-income students. We want to make college prices more predictable and transparent. We want to provide incentives to students and institutions to increase completion and lower prices. And we want to make sure that federal, state, and institutional policies and programs are aligned. And we believe that there's a good base in research and experience that doing these things will increase the overall level of higher education attainment. Looks like it didn't save my Connecticut version of this presentation. I apologize for that. So again, a little bit of perspective. We talk about financial aid often as its own policy, but it is a relatively small proportion of overall higher education spending in the United States and probably in Connecticut as well. And by far the biggest form of financial aid that students get in public institutions in most states is the appropriation to institutions that keeps resident tuition lower than the cost of education. And in this sense, Connecticut is no exception. These are data from the NASGAP report, the National Association of State Student Grant and Aid Programs, and the State Higher Education Executive Officers Finance Survey. In the United States, states spend an average of about $700 per FTE student on designated financial aid programs. It's about $11 billion a year among all 50 states. By contrast, the federal government spends about $40 billion a year in financial aid across the 50 states, and states spend about $70 billion a year in state appropriations across the 50 states. And in an even larger context, higher education is a $500 billion industry across the United States. So we're talking about $11 billion in state financial aid out of a $500 billion overall higher education industry. And the question is, how do we take this relatively small investment and make it as strategic as possible so that it can have as much leverage as possible? So in Connecticut, I pulled these data from the College Board and CHEF, so it's not my fault if they're off. But you spent about $300 on average for state financial aid in 2013-14 per FTE student, about $7,200 in state appropriations. So much more than the designated financial aid investment. And your tuition rates across the four-year sector at about $11,400 a year and in the two-year sector of about $4,000 are considerably less than the cost of instruction in those sectors. So even before you start thinking about federal and state financial aid, students who are paying resident tuition rates are getting a significant discount. And I would encourage you also to think when you're thinking about your goal, not just to think about the $300, but think about the $7,200. And to what extent is that much larger investment in Connecticut driving you toward the goals that you want for the state? But we're here today to talk mostly about the $300. While a relatively small part of the pie, it's an important one, and there are ways to make it more or less effective. So I also wanted to talk about some of the things that Connecticut is doing right and a couple of things that aren't on this slide. When I do go around to other states, there are a few things in Connecticut that other states are interested in. One is the consolidation of programs that you had in the Governor's Scholarship Program. A lot of states have a pretty bewildering and tangled array of programs that have been created over 50, 100, 200 years. Nobody ever wants to get rid of a program that's created. So they might have 30 different financial aid programs, and nobody but a handful of people in the state capitol actually understand them. So when states are asking for examples of other states that have consolidated their programs into something that's easier to explain, I share with them what Connecticut did with the Governor's Scholarship Program, which I know many of you think is not perfect, and no state has found a perfect solution. But just as far as accomplishing that task of consolidation, it is an example. The other things that other states are interested in Connecticut, are the Go Back to Get Ahead program that you had here, where you tried to recruit, and I think successfully recruited, some adult students to come back and take courses with the idea of completing their degree. Again, not necessarily a perfect program, and maybe not timed as well as it could have been in the economic cycle. You might have preferred to have that program come in 2010, 2009, when unemployment rates were a lot higher. But still a good attempt to innovate with how you reach adults on a statewide basis and try to get them back into higher education. You also have an institution in Connecticut that other states don't have. You have Charter Oak College, which is a state college, which is one of only a handful of institutions in the country that really specializes in aggregating students' educational experiences and getting them to finish their degrees at the lowest cost possible by leveraging what they've done before. And frankly, a lot of students in Florida have taken advantage of Charter Oak State College because there's nothing in our state that is equivalent to that. And it's cheaper for them to take the credits they've earned at Florida community colleges, in the military, wherever it's been, and see what they need to complete online with Charter Oak State College than to do anything in-state. And it's a hard thing to invent if you don't already have one. So I think it's important to not to while you're trying to innovate and fix the problems that you have in your state, to recognize some of the things that other states are a little bit envious of you for having already. You also have in the Governor's Scholarship Program and in the general tone of the conversation that I've heard here, you have the right emphasis on need-based aid. Even with the merit-based component of the Governor's Scholarship, most of it, I think, is still based on need, and the presentation you had from the University of Connecticut reflected the, at least the flagship institution's prioritization of the neediest students. So that's a good start, and it's not where all states are. The research base in financial aid suggests that financial aid can be very effective, but it is only effective for students who actually need the money. At higher levels of income, it may affect where students go to college, but it won't affect whether they go or whether they complete. So just by focusing on need, you're already focusing on an area where you are likely to have the biggest impact on students. I gave a couple of examples there of other states. Pell Grants, Cal Grants, of course, are based on need. In some southern states that have merit-based programs, to the extent that the research has shown the HOPE Scholarship or other programs to be effective, it tends to be at the lower levels of academic qualification within the scholarships and for the whatever proportion of the students actually have financial need. So they can be effective. It's just probably not the most efficient way to go about it. So there's some other issues with achieving the maximum effect with financial aid that include sizing. So if you have an award that's too small, you risk having no effect at all. If you have an award that's too big, it may be more than is needed to produce the result. So Rhode Island, I think, has changed, but it was an example of a broad-based, smaller award that actually went to students, including those who went out of state, and spread the award across a broad population of students. One of the largest statewide awards is in Maryland, which has a maximum of $19,000 in the Guaranteed Access Program, but serves, I think, less than 1,000 students in a fairly large state. So Minnesota is a state that tries to right-size its awards by combining federal aid and state aid in a single package. And this is also an example of creating some consistency and predictability in a statewide award process. So rather than simply thinking of the statewide financial aid program, which is a relatively small part of the pie, in isolation, Minnesota essentially takes credit for federal financial aid as well. And it says, we are going to guarantee that students will have to pay no more or borrow no more than 50% of the cost of attendance after we take into account their EFC, the other sources of federal aid that are available to them. Then we'll fill in the gaps with state financial aid. And so they package state and federal aid together across a sliding scale that creates equal gaps for everybody, essentially, across the state. And then institutions can add to that, as some do. The University of Minnesota, for example, has additional aid available since it's one of the higher cost institutions that actually reduces that further. But across the state, there's a guarantee that no one will have to borrow more than 50% of the cost of attendance. So one way of thinking about where state financial aid fits is by taking the full cost of education in a state to start with. And this is just sort of a stylized example where you think of a four-year education at a four-year school as roughly a $100,000 investment that somebody has to make, including the cost of instruction, the student's budget for living expenses and books. And that might be a 2+2 degree at a fairly low-cost four-year institution and a community college for the first couple of years. So who's going to pay for that, and where are the remaining gaps? The first piece at the bottom is the state support through appropriations that actually reduces the gap between the cost and what the student pays to start with. The second part you might look at is the parent contribution, which at the bottom income levels is going to be zero or nearly zero. The third part you might look at is what federal support is available, either through Pell Grants or through the tax credits that middle-income families can get. And then you think about what might be a reasonable amount of work that students could do. Whatever you think it might be, 10 hours, 15 hours at minimum wage, and what does that generate toward the cost of attendance? And then you have a policy decision about what level of loans you might think would be acceptable. In this case, it's assuming about a $15,000 debt level, $2,500 at the first 2 years and $5,000 at the second 2 years. And then you have put in the state financial aid. And most states, Connecticut is fairly typical in this sense, have a fairly small level of state financial aid relative to the overall picture of higher education costs, and you fill in that. In a state that has a fairly broad eligibility standard, it might actually increase the total available resources to a student at an upper middle income level if it goes that high, but it might not quite reach the gap for a family at the bottom income level. In a state that had a larger, more generous program for the lowest income families, it might actually be more generous for students at the bottom income level and leave more of a gap in the middle. Almost every state that I've worked with thinks that it has a middle class squeeze in college costs, and a few of them do, but my experience is that when you look at it this way, most of them do not. I'm not sure where Connecticut would fall in this sense, but it's one way to think about where the gaps are across the state. So Lumina Foundation has recently piloted a benchmark for affordability that it calls the Rule of 10, which is the idea that the cost of a degree should be something that a student can pay for with 10 years of savings prior to entering based on a 10% of their family's disposable income, plus the income for working 10 hours per week while they're enrolled full time. This isn't something necessarily that you would want to replicate in exactly those terms, but you might think about what your version of it would be. And I do apologize. The version of my presentation that I had edited and put in the examples from Connecticut did not seem to save, and so you can tell which state I was last talking to about this issue. You're moving in the right direction on predictable and transparency, but you probably have a ways to go. There are two ways that financial aid can work. One is by providing resources for students to do what they otherwise wouldn't be able to do, whether that's to pay their tuition, pay their rent, not have to work as much. So the resources that students get through financial aid that fills in that gap enables them to attend. The other important way that financial aid works is as an incentive. And incentives only work to the extent that they are known in advance and that they are predictable. So if you're using your financial aid strictly as a financial support, you're losing a significant part of the potential impact of the aid program. And there's an increasing research base to support this based on very rigorous research. Most financial aid research, including some I've done, to be honest, is not that rigorous. It's either descriptive or based on regression analysis, but we have more studies that are based on controlled experiments with genuine experimental design that are showing how some of these programs can work. So the idea is that programs that people understand work better than those that people do not understand. So it's not just the amount of the program, but how it's designed that makes a difference. So the sooner students know about what financial aid is available, the longer the same dollar can have an effect. So a dollar that a student knows about only after they've chosen where to go to college and enrolled in the and where they're going to enroll can support them while they're enrolled, and it can reduce their costs and increase the likelihood of their retention of retaining and completing a degree. And there's a good research base to support that. It cannot very easily serve as an incentive for the student since they don't know in advance what's going to be there and how it's going to work. If there are benchmarks, they have to be seen as attainable within students' or schools' control. So students have more control over which courses to take, whether they fill out the FAFSA, than they do necessarily over what their test scores will be or their high GPA. So studies that have tried to incentivize getting better test scores or increasing GPAs don't show as promising results as those that suggest you take particular courses, you fill out the FAFSA, or you do other behavioral types of things that students have control over. So some of the best practices in this area are the statewide promise programs for low-income middle school students in three states, Indiana, Washington, and Oklahoma, which provide statewide guarantees to students in eighth grade who qualify for free and reduced lunch that if they graduate from high school, fill out the FAFSA, and attend a public institution in that state, their tuition will be paid for. So unlike some of the other programs, the merit-based programs in Florida and Georgia, these are only for low-income middle school students. And experience shows that almost all students who qualify for free and reduced lunch in middle school, by the time they get to college, if they fill out the FAFSA, will qualify for financial aid anyway. A few don't, and so this guarantee actually does result in some students getting financial aid who otherwise wouldn't, but the vast majority do. So it's providing a guarantee of generally aid that the state or the federal government already would have spent. So there's an emerging experimental research base that's supporting this model. And one of the best studies is an early commitment scholarship program in New Brunswick. It's from Canada, but the system is similar enough there that I think it applies down here. There's an upcoming study from a Milwaukee program and one in Nebraska that are more local but showing similar results. This one had true experimental design. The students, some students received, were offered this program, and others were in a control group. And they were offered $8,000 in learning accounts per participant in the treatment group during high school. They got $2,000 in ninth grade, $2,000 in 10th grade, and $4,000 on high school graduation, and also some college counseling and career advising that went along with that. It had impacts on enrollment. It had an even bigger impact on completion after 4 years. So it's been more than 8 years now since ninth grade, so we can actually see the students completing. The biggest impact by far was on the low-income and first-generation college students. And one of the more significant findings is that for the low-income recipients, not for the high-income recipients who wouldn't have gotten financial aid from the province, but for the low-income recipients, there was no increase in total amount of government aid expenditure per student. So the aid that they got that they were promised through this program was aid that they would have received anyway through the provincial need-based financial aid program. But they had double the completion rates after 8 years, twice as many of the ninth graders who in the treatment group completed degrees after 8 years as students in the control group. So it's not necessarily that you need to do it exactly this way, but it illustrates the principle of how the same dollar, whether it's a dollar that the province is spending after a student enrolls and gets some financial aid to support them in college, or a dollar that the student knows about in ninth grade that they were going to get anyway, has a much bigger impact on the outcomes for the students. And this is the study. There should be a new one coming up. It's not. I checked this morning. It wasn't out, but this is from last year. And this is showing all the green are the positive results, which kind of cluster around the low-income students and the first-generation students. And boys, too, for some reason, more likely to respond, although positive results really all down the line. So I think that's one of the big issues for states that are trying to figure out how to leverage their financial aid dollars is creating some kind of transparency around what's often a very small investment compared to the overall investment in higher education that states are making. States are spending $70 billion a year in appropriations, $11 billion a year in financial aid. So how do you get that $11 billion to leverage the $70 billion. Transparency is part of it. And I think one program that I didn't talk about here, but that is an attempt to do the same thing in a slightly different way, and many of you may have heard of, is the Tennessee Promise Program for Free Community College. And I have to. This is a program that I was pretty skeptical of at first. The part of me that likes to think for in the economic sense and favors need-based aid, since it offers state funds for community college students only after Pell Grants are taken into account, it means that the state money in the program is really only going to students who don't qualify for Pell Grants. So it's not going to the neediest students in the state. So in that sense, it's not an efficient program in terms of who the state dollars are going to. But as a transparency exercise, the $14 million in Tennessee state funds that are going into it are leveraging a much larger federal investment in financial aid. So as a FAFSA completion and marketing effort to get the state interested in higher education, it is actually creating much more transparency. So the reality is that community college is already free in Tennessee for the vast majority of high school graduates who are going on to community college in Tennessee. They just didn't know it. So what this allows the governor to do and the state is to go around and say, you know, community college is free. We're putting, you know, our little bit of state funding in a guarantee to ensure that that's true. And so far this year, they've had a 12% increase in community college enrollments when almost every other state has had a decline. They're by far the top state in FAFSA completion rates this year. And some of those students are going to four-year schools. If they complete a FAFSA and realize that they can get, you know, $6,000 in Pell Grant money and maybe some other funds, They may say, well, you know, actually, this is enough to go to Tennessee Tech. I don't have to go to the community college. So the enrollments have dropped a little bit at public four-year institutions in Tennessee, but they've dropped everywhere around the country, and Tennessee's declines are consistent with the overall national trend and demographics. It hasn't resulted in the sky falling. At independent institutions, there's, I think, one institution that's had a sharper than expected decline in enrollment. So there may have been some effect there. In a sense, the jury's still out. Are these students going to finish their credentials at Tennessee community colleges? Tennessee has the largest outcomes-based funding system in the country, so community colleges only get state money if students pass progress benchmarks. You don't get enrollment money from the state. You get money after students complete remediation, after they attain 12 hours, 24 hours, 36 hours, and after they get their associate degree. So there's a huge incentive for the institutions to make sure that the students are making progress. And that's something that other states that have been talking about doing something similar typically don't have in place. It's also the governor's top priority. So he's on the phone with superintendents and community college presidents, and everybody knows that this is something where the governor's putting a lot of political capital in. That's also something where that's a helpful asset in a state that really wants to move the needle on this. But again, it's something where an investment in a program that seems strictly as financial aid leveraging in terms of financial need looks pretty inefficient from an economist's point of view, but as a marketing idea and a transparency, on that side of the equation, it looks like it's working pretty well. I'm happy to talk a little bit about timing and deadlines, too. I know that can be an issue in a lot of states. That's over the course of the recession, a lot of states that were cutting their financial aid budgets were running out of funds. And one popular way to make their dollars stretch was to move the deadlines up. So they'd run out of money and it was sort of first come, first serve. That's probably the worst possible way to ration financial aid in terms of reaching students who will benefit from it. The students who meet earlier deadlines are typically the ones who are most likely to go to college anyway, because knowing what you're going to do and meeting deadlines and having access to the internet and having good school guidance counselors and access to those resources are all things that are not evenly distributed. I'd advocate almost any way of allocating limited resources other than that one. There's some examples, if you'd like to talk about them, of states that have tried to find ways around this. I don't know the extent to which this is a big issue in Connecticut as well. There's more opportunity now with the earlier FAFSA filing data and the prior year filing to actually give students more lead time to accept applications earlier, but also possibly extend the period of accepting them later as well. So I'm happy to answer questions. I know every state's got a slightly different set of issues, and I hope I've addressed some of the ones that you're thinking about here. And if not, then let me know what's on your mind.
I'll open it up to questions. I know I have several, but I'll wait till the end. Hopefully they'll be answered before I need to ask them.
Nate, just a real easy question. Would we be able to get a copy of your presentation?
Yes, and I'll actually replace Maryland with Connecticut in all the places where it didn't get done. But, yes, I'll send that out.
Okay.
you've given us a lot of information just now, and sort of feels like that sort of fire hose moment where you're trying to sort of take it all in and sort of come up with it. But I am intrigued by something that you said around the Tennessee Promise proposal. As I see it, like when I think about your presentation, I think about there's lots of sort of small splash initiatives that can happen around, and that's primarily, I think, what this task force has been focusing on. How can we make some incremental improvements, much needed incremental improvements, in the way that we deliver financial aid?
Right.
And then there are a couple of examples that you gave that I would describe as big splash. And so the promise initiatives that you included in your PowerPoint and the Tennessee promise, I think, are sort of different kinds of initiatives, right?
Right.
But you mentioned, and specifically when you were referencing Tennessee, that there were impacts that were being seen not just in the community college system, but also in other public institutions and in private institutions. That I think is sort of interesting. Could you just expound on that a little bit? Because I'm interested in knowing what, typically when I think about those kinds of proposals, I think about, well, that's going to have an enormous impact on their community college system, but you seem to indicate that they're having a broader impact.
Right. And to the point that the difference between the small proposals and the large ones, there's a continuum there, and I think anything that moves you in the direction of more transparency and predictability, whether it's free community college, I'm not sure that's exactly the right program, but or some kind of commitment program like that, or whether it's just moving your notification letters up by a month, or having a minimum guarantee of what the financial aid award would be for Connecticut residents who are in the eligibility criteria. I mean, it could be there are incremental ways to improve the transparency and predictability of the program, as well as sort of big splash ideas. And the Tennessee Promise Program is not a large financial commitment for the state. It's $14 million in a state that's, I think, probably bigger than Connecticut in population. But it's leveraging the existing federal investment and the existing state investment that they were already putting into their financial aid programs. And again, this is something where I know a little bit about a lot of states, so I can't get into a whole lot of detail about what's happening with Tennessee Promise without getting over my head. But I know that one of the fears of the public four-year sector was that it would attract a lot of students out of going to the four-year institutions and going to the two-year institutions. And in this first year of enrollment, that seems not to be happening, at least the drops in freshman enrollment are no larger than they are anywhere else in the country in Tennessee. And then the institutions, assuming that some of the students complete their associate degrees, there will be more transfer students coming into the four-year institutions later. That's about as far as I can go. I know the independent institutions also had similar concerns. Most of them have not seen declines in their enrollments, but according to the head of the program who I talked to a couple weeks ago, one of them has had some declines. I will try to get you more information about that too from the source.
Nate, I guess I have my first question, and hopefully other people will start asking questions. But so state appropriations to state-funded grants, approximately across the country, $11 billion out of a half trillion. So we're looking at 2%, right, of the funding. In some ways, it seems like we're the tail trying to wag the dog. And this is what we have the most control over, so this is what we've been focused on. But what are the other areas that as a state setting policy we can look at to try to greater impact our goals of increasing educational attainment, right? The percentage of students who have a post-secondary degree.
Right. Well, if you think about what would higher education look like if there were no state investment at all, actually only have to go up to New Hampshire to look for that. Seriously, it's there would be some students who, without any kind of subsidy, would still manage to get through college. And the four-year tuition, two- and four-year tuition in New Hampshire is pretty close to the cost of offering the education. There's a little bit of state local support, but not much. And still, a lot of students actually manage to go. So what is the purpose of the state investment? It's to enable those students who wouldn't otherwise be able to go or get through as quickly, perhaps, to attend and attend quickly. And what that gives you, if once you've agreed as a state that you want to improve your educational attainment, you then have kind of a yardstick to measure policy ideas against and say, if we allocate this way or we change the program this way or we prioritize student aid over institutional appropriations, or the other way around, if we prioritize institutional appropriations over state aid, what is going to best help us reach this goal? I think that you have an opportunity. Everyone at individual institutions who works with students, they all want students to succeed, right? They want what's best for the students at their institutions and what's best for the state. They're limited, and I've worked at institutions, public and private, and I know the limitations of that as well. An institution can make the best possible allocation among its students and they have a lot more information than the state does about what resources students have. But they won't find a student at a different institution who's needier and write a check to that institution. So if to the extent that your need is not even among your institutions, your state program can fill that gap. An institution by itself, unless it's in a state, you know, maybe Rhode Island, where there's only one of each kind of institution, or the University of Wyoming, cannot by itself implement a state policy about what the state's investment in higher education is. So the state has an opportunity with its investment, just as the federal government does with its and institutions do with theirs, to make a statement about their philosophy and their priorities and communicate to students what Connecticut's role in higher education attainment is and to ask something of students as well that is maybe a little bit different from what the federal government asks of students through Pell Grants. And then institutions, given what the state's done and what the federal government does, can add their piece to that. There's kind of a logical order to it. I would ask, kind of return the question to you, do you have a clear request of students in your state for your investment in financial aid or for your state appropriation as well? Is what are you asking of them and what are you committing to them in return? And do they know that? Is your policy clearly reflected in that? Because if they don't know what you're asking, they can't do it. That's one reason that the promise programs work so well, is that you ask something very specific of the students, something that a lot of them can do, and you make a clear commitment in return.
Thank you. One of the things you kind of reminded me of another question. You mentioned completion, right? Getting students in to complete. And speaking with you before, you had talked a little bit about Indiana's program, and I guess can you just, for the benefit of the whole group, describe that? With incentivizing students who take 30 credit hours, and then also, I think one of the interesting things when you had spoken about Indiana's state program is the impact it had on institution policies as well.
Right. So a few years ago, and I worked with Indiana on this policy as a consultant, too, so I full disclosure, of course, what the legislature enacted was not exactly what I recommended, surprise, surprise, but what they did was to replace some of their they were moving in a more merit aid direction because they were concerned that they were seeing low completion rates among their need-based aid recipients. So they'd raised the GPA requirements for some of their need-based financial aid programs. And what we recommended and what they did instead was to replace that, to bring the grade point average back down and replace it with standards for the numbers of credits students completed toward their degree. So students in Indiana can only get the maximum state financial aid award if they complete 30 credits. They can get less if they complete fewer credits. But that provides some additional incentive and some additional support for students who are on track to attend to graduate on time. And that's also an area where the Pell Grant has gaps because it's capped at 12 credits a term. So costs increase after 12 credits, but you get more Pell Grant at, you know, 3 credits, 6 credits, 9 credits, 12 credits, and then it's capped. So if you're a low-income student and you want to take 15 hours, you have to pay every penny yourself to do that. So it was one way of addressing that, too, by making the largest allocations to students who are on track to do that. The interesting thing that I saw in Indiana after they implemented the program, I mean, first of all, the results are really impressive. Their rates of the number of students who are taking 15 hours per term are way up across the state. Their retention rates are not down, so it's not true that students fail more, drop out if they try to take more credits. So the overall numbers of students who are reaching sophomore year on time are way up. But the interesting that I've seen, I also work with states that are interested in outcomes-based funding, but the change in institutional practices in Indiana has been much faster and much more significant than even when they implemented an outcomes-based funding formula. They've changed their advising. They changed what they do with summers. A lot of institutions that used to have relatively small summer programs and no financial aid for summer created summer financial aid programs. Purdue University started flagging students who were not on track to complete 30 hours and intervening with them in May and offering them summer scholarships to complete 6 hours over the summer. They've had a 50% increase in the percentage of students taking low-income aid-eligible students taking 15 hours per term. It's really been a landscape change in Indiana. There's still only 1.5 years into implementation, so we're still kind of looking at retention data, things like that. But so far, it's pretty positive.
Jen,
I just have to acknowledge that I think that the intent of the Governor's Scholarship, as it was crafted, was to be predictable and transparent. And so I'm just curious, but there's just not the funding to go along with it because of the challenges that we face. So I'm just curious around the programs that you're identifying as sort of models, like how many of them are guaranteed entitlements and how many aren't?
Well, that's why I said it was probably a step in the right direction, but it's not quite there yet because having a wide array of confusing and unfunded programs, and you've consolidated them into one clearer but not completely funded program. So the next step is either funding it or finding a way that you can commit to students that they're going to get something and they can know in advance what it is. So which is either a matter of increasing your spending on the program to fit the number of students and the award sizes that you commit to, or reducing the award size, or reducing the pool of eligible students to meet your budget. And any of those things would probably increase the leverage and the effectiveness of the program, although, you know, there would be challenges with each one. So states that have tried to do this, there are some states that have a strict entitlement program, like Cal Grants, and that's just the first thing that the legislature funds every year, and it's guaranteed, and it works pretty well. If you look at the rates of low-income students attending the University of California institutions, they're way above their peers nationally. To that extent, it works. It's also costs $1 billion a year. I mean, it's an expensive program. But that's a commitment the state has made. Other states try to size the... So what Indiana does now is they size the award to their budget. And they estimate as early as they can what size of award they'll be able to afford within the pool of eligible students, and they try to communicate that as early as they can to the students so that they will know what they would get at a community college, at a public four-year institution, at a private four-year institution if they qualify for the award. It's not 100% guarantee because, you know, the statute and the funding process don't allow that, but it's as close as they can get. And then they've also done some administrative tweaking so that they don't have to reissue award levels if, you know, something changes by $50 or something like that, so that they can kind of make awards within these bands that are easier to communicate. So they have kind of a grid, which I'd be happy to share with you. But you have one for the Governor's Scholarship, too. You just haven't funded it completely. But it's an adjustable grid. So they adjust the grid based on their projections of eligibility and take-up.
Just one more. I'm sorry, Roberta. I mean, we don't really have one program. I mean, we have three programs with one name. So, I mean, all of the programs are, yes, it's good in that it's not sector-specific, but it's still three programs. So, I mean, I feel like, you know, if we're to fund everything to be need merit so that, or the way that need merit's awarded centrally, so that students would know in advance in the fall, if you go to this school, you get that much. If you go to, that's one way of doing it. That's not how it's done right now. It feels like everything's later, and partially because of the way it's crafted, that they can't, they're waiting, OHE has to wait till they get the prior year data, et cetera. So I would just, I mean, and then part of it's campus issued. So it's, I mean, I just appreciate your insight on the fact that we really have three programs, it feels like.
Right. Well, it's like I said, it may not be all the way there yet. That's also fairly typical too. The Cal Grant is actually three programs, but it's branded as the Cal Grant. I mean, it does make it easier to communicate. Indiana's program is actually two programs, but it's branded and explained in a single way. And there, you know, probably are ways to improve on that too. So I would kind of challenge you to think about how could you make it more predictable for students in Connecticut to know what the state part of their college expenses would be. How early could you make that commitment? How strong could you make that commitment? Some other states have sort of a minimum award, and then they're very conservative, and this is to some extent what Indiana does. They under-project so that they don't, that the grid they produce is sort of a very conservative one, and then that gives them some more money that they can allocate during the summer. It's also something where you could have you could estimate an 80% level, and then that would give you some wiggle room if projections weren't off, and give the rest to institutions to allocate. There are ways to kind of bring up the forecasting process which, by the way, is much easier to do at the state level than at the institutional level. It's a lot easier to project financial need and attendance patterns across a state than it is to predict them at an individual institution, because your number of high school graduates is fairly predictable. The proportion who go to community colleges, four-year schools, and independent schools might vary a little from year to year. But at a single institution, you can have wild swings from year to year in take-up rates and yield based on what your competitors are doing. It's much harder to do it at an institutional level than at the state level.
I just want to point out, with the Governor's Scholarship Program, we do have something similar to Indiana with the Academic Incentive Award, which increases a need-based recipient's award if they complete 30 credits. So that's there. It's in its infancy, but we do try to give $1,000 more to those students.
Is that just at your institution, or that's part of the Governor's Scholarship?
That's for any student who receives the need-based grant who achieves 30 or more credits in the prior year, and there is like a GPA cutoff that's in there, which is 3L right now, they get an extra bump. We don't want to penalize them for not doing it, but we increase. The other thing as to the concern about the lateness, the Governor's Scholarship Program, the timing of things are pretty much exactly the same as our old programs. The times that it has been late really is, as we know, more of a state process and budgeting issue that we have to wait also. So I guess it's interesting to hear about states who are somehow able to predetermine before the budgeting process how much awards will be. Do those states have problems when they have to back off of those projections that they're giving out to families?
Yes. I mean, when they've had to do that, they do. It is partly a political commitment as well, however far you're making that commitment in advance. So, legislatures can undo what they do. But in California, it would be a difficult thing to do politically to not fund the Cal grants. In states, some states have biennial legislatures and they fund across a biennium, and you can do rolling funding too, where you can carry over, even with an annual legislature, you can carry over a surplus and ensure that there's always a buffer. But then you can run into, one-time events like the 2008 recession, where everything gets thrown off, and you have to backfill. So, in that setting, Oregon had to ended up only really being able to fund 1 year of its biennial budget for its commitment. Minnesota ended up asking institutions to fill the deficit through their resources 1 year, which they did. They have a 30-year history of funding the aid program in Minnesota across Democrats, Republicans. They've been very consistent about it, and it's got wide support across the state. And I think the other thing you get with a system like that is there's maybe a little less competition among public, private, 2 year, 4 year. They all see that they're benefiting from having the state support this program, and so they kind of rally to support it in a time of crisis. So they in that case the institutions filled in the amount the state wasn't going to be able to provide. And then they also ratcheted down slightly the percentage guarantee. I can't remember what it was, but the percentage of the cost of attendance, which they were able to do evenly, right? So they said, okay, we can't meet 50% of the cost of attendance this year, so we'll meet 45% of it. but that way it didn't disproportionately fall on any one group or sector or student.
Nate, thank you. This has been really, really helpful for those of us who've been looking at this issue of financial aid, and certainly the Planning Commission for Higher Education, obviously our goals on reaching the underrepresented low-income students, not only getting them into school, maybe not the enrollment, but obviously getting them some sort of credential, some sort of post-secondary credential. I found all of the different, several of those models that you presented extremely compelling. You get to one, explain it, and I said, oh, we're going to do that. And then you got to the next one. Oh, we should. That's even better than the one before. So obviously we need to do some massaging of all these different options and where, you know, what we might think about. And this is not something you do overnight, but you think about it. But one of the things I thought was very interesting for me was the New Brunswick model. And the reason why I think that that is extremely compelling is getting our students, you know, Connecticut has some of the poorest cities, Bridgeport, in the United States, being one of them. And so they're not college ready. They get to school, they need developmental aid because they never, developmental education, because they're not prepared for college. And they don't have the skills that are needed to be successful. So when you describe the New Brunswick one, it's sort of giving hope to those in the 10th, 11th, 12th year that college could be in their future. I think it almost creates a different mindset, you know, mm-hmm. to persistence, grit, you know, all the sort of components that might get to the fact that they're not prepared to succeed when they get to the door. All the other programs are basically saying we can make it affordable once you get to the door. So that's something to think about, is getting students to think about that they could go to college much earlier. So, you know, that's not something I'd thought about before, but that is really very interesting. So I want to thank you, and I hope that you will continue to work with us, maybe to guide us. We're trying not to do things where we'd like to do it based on research and information as opposed to legislative initiatives. That don't necessarily have that kind of due diligence that goes into selecting a program. So I want to thank you very much for getting us to think about a variety of different things we might do here in Connecticut.
Well, thank you for having me up here in my birthplace state.
And again, being mindful of the time and that I think we only have the room till 12:30. We are nearing 12:30. One last question for you, Nate. How do we continue to work with you going forward? In what ways can you support our group in its efforts?
Well, I am happy to confer with the group as a whole or any members who have additional questions. And you have my contact information, so... just let me know what you need, and we'll try to make sure you get it. If it's not me, if you want more information about a particular state to kind of dig into depth, we may be able to get you in touch with the right people from the states that you're most interested in. So you can ask all the questions that I can't answer about Tennessee Promise or whatever other state it might be.
Great. Thank you very much. Roberta, I was wondering, this is our last meeting before the session begins, if you could just talk a little bit about what legislative initiatives to expect for the coming session?
Well, we are putting in some fixes to our present governor's scholarship. We've had this task force, subcommittee of the Planning Commission, working. Some of them are really obvious fixes on using prior, moving up deadlines. We are looking at the incentive grant, whether it's we've heard from the schools that this is very difficult for them to implement, and it really isn't that much, you know, are we getting the bang for the buck on that one? So, and we're looking at merit need-based aid, whether we just start thinking in terms of merit. So those are, what? Well, we have right now, we have merit need and need. And so the question is, you know, how do we approach the merit piece of that? And maybe we should be looking at need, who's the most needy. So, but those are all questions that we're going to be massaging. We will be putting a bill out there. Those of you who are interested, I hope you'll come and testify and help us to improve it. I do want to thank Jen and Greg and Steve. I believe you've been working on it. I don't know who else I should thank. Julie. I thank all of you for your efforts and putting some really good suggestions. I do have to say that I'm extremely impressed with the people who have come to the table over the last several months with their ideas, and it's been extraordinarily helpful in guiding us. But obviously now we have some other things to think about for the future, what we might do. So thank you, and thank you for James for herding us cats. So,
and I guess so. Then, Robert, I guess we will not be meeting during this session. I would assume that we wouldn't have another meeting of this group, or will there be the opportunity? We'll continue to work. Okay.
Yeah. For instance, if the bill gets introduced, I would hope that would be another opportunity to have that conversation as people submit testimony on it. So the fact that we're not maybe meeting in February, you are going to have the opportunity to help us craft something. And the same thing you'd say about going into March. I do want to pursue this conversation, and we may be putting in some sort of bill to address some of the bigger issues that were raised today. And Representative Haddad has some ideas that he would like to massage. So we just need to figure out how that's going to all play out. But again, thank you.
And so then we will be continuing. I think one of the goals that we had discussed at the last meeting when you weren't able to make it was the hope that we could continue on as a working group, because I think there are more long-term issues to. Okay. So we will be continuing. We will be meeting, it appears, during session. And as in fact from past meetings, wait for Jeannie to let us know what we need to do. So, again, thank you all for all of the time and effort you've put into this meeting, and we are adjourned.